This is producer David O'Leary with a quick reminder to our listeners. For the next few months in 2024, we will be releasing several remaining episodes featuring the late Richard McSpadden, including today's episode. We hope you enjoy this edition of There I Was.
We were flying along at cruise, was about 150 knots, and we slowed down to about 100 knots. But as we reached that 100 knots, and we're just about to change the configuration, there was a loud bang in the tail section of the airplane. And I mean a loud one, like a shotgun going off. Certainly not a normal sound.
Welcome to another edition of There I Was, a podcast where we put you in the cockpit with pilots in demanding situations and we learn how they flew out of them. I'm your host, Richard McSpadden. Today's guest is retired United Captain John Bloom. John's got over 34,000 flight hours. Not only is he a retired captain from United, but he's a longtime general aviation pilot, and currently he serves as director of aviation for Lone Star College, where he's the chief instructor and also an on-site DPE. Today he's going to share a story with us where he was acting in that DPE capacity when he had a flight control malfunction that created a pretty challenging situation. John, welcome to the There I Was podcast.
Good morning, Richard. Very happy to be here.
So, John, your story is so interesting to us because flight control malfunctions, structural failures are rare, and yet you experienced one. Share your story with us.
Richard, it was a Wednesday about lunchtime on May 3rd of 2023. My student and I, my check applicant, Darlene, was preparing for her check ride to add a multi-engine rating to her commercial certificate. It was a beautiful day here in Houston where we fly. It's been unusually hot, but this particular day was only in the 80s. Not a cloud in the sky and not a whisper of wind. So one of those perfect check ride days. We were flying in a Piper Seneca, a PA-34, which is a small twin-engine training aircraft that we use. The airplane was pre-flighted and everything had checked out great. Darlene did all her pre-flight duties and we got into the airplane and started our taxi out at our home airport, which is in Conroe, Texas. Conroe's a town just north of Houston.
Charlie X-ray Oscar for those following along in their four flight at home.
Right. Thank you. Conroe's a fairly busy airport. We have, I think, 6 to 7 flight schools there. So we're all, vying for the airspace. So on this particular day, we decided to go out north of Conroe Airport to do our airborne maneuvers as part of the check ride to begin with. We were departing on runway 14 to the southeast, and we got our clearance for takeoff. And again, everything working just perfectly. The airplane was just purring like a kitten, and Darlene was doing her duties just as a commercial pilot would do. We got airborne and were directed to turn left out of the traffic pattern, and we climbed north northeastbound as we climbed up to an altitude of about 3,500 feet for our initial maneuvers. The first planned maneuver, once we got out of the Towers airspace, the Class Delta, up to the north, was going to be a series of steep turns just to kind of get warmed up for the check itself. We got about 15 to 18 miles north, northeast of Conroe, and I asked Darlene to clear the area, do our pre-maneuver checklist, clearing the area, checking for possible locations to land if something went wrong and we needed to land off airport and make sure we were in the right configuration and seat belts and all that kind of stuff you do just before you enter a maneuver.
Now, that's interesting to me, John, because that kind of thought process, I always do single engine, like in case the engine fails, where am I going to put this airplane? But it's not typically a thought process I go through when I'm flying multi-engine. So that's interesting to me that you always do that, even though you're flying a multi-engine aircraft, it still goes through your sort of thinking of, where am I going to put this airplane down?
Right. It's always in the back of your mind that I'm in a multi-engine airplane, and what's the worst thing that could happen? Lose one engine. But on this particular day and every day, our school and our processes that we'd go through this list mentally and verbally, whether we're in a multi-engine or a single-engine airplane for training. And in this particular day, it really came in handy because as we prepared for the maneuver, Darlene cleared the area. Everything was fine. We didn't see any other traffic. And she began the steep turns, which we started to the left. Again, we're at 3,500 feet, started a left turn. Our target was a 55 degrees of bank and make a left 360, maintain altitude and airspeed, roll out on the heading that we started, and then start a right turn at 55 degrees of bank, maintaining altitude and speed all the way around to the initial heading again. And Darlene she's got over 200 hours of flight time as we got to this point, and she's very a little bit nervous to begin with, but you could tell as we went through the turns that she was calming down and getting her nerves under control, and she did a very excellent job in the steep turns. And that's always an indicator to an examiner or a check instructor that, hey, this check ride is going to go really good. The student, the applicant has got her nerves under control and things are going to happen, and this is going to be a successful day.
So that's pretty typical where you'll give them a steep turn as a warm-up to just help them get in the game, something relatively easy. They should start out as a confidence builder, soothe the nerves a little bit, right? So that's what you're seeing, and so far going pretty much as you'd hope as an examiner.
Exactly. So after that, not only was Darlene getting a little more calm, but I was getting a little more confident, you know, internally that we can go into the next maneuver. And I could get to my plan of action, so to speak, as the maneuvers came together and we completed this check ride. And we were flying over an area, it's called the Sam Houston Forest. It's an area just north of Conroe, about 30 miles northeast of Houston. Thousands of acres of nothing but trees, you know, hence the name forest. So it was an area that didn't have a lot of places to see that were open or cleared. If anything was cleared, it'd be a small patch of ground that someone would be raising cattle or horses on out in the middle of all this forest. So that's the picture, blue sky and nothing but trees below us and a few odd and ends, little clearings here and there. And we had our eye on one. Remember from that first clearing maneuver we did have our eye on one of the larger clearings, which wasn't big at all, probably the size of a Minute Maid Park, or if you're an Astros fan or a baseball fan at all. And as we came to the second maneuver, which is going to be slow flight, and then some maneuvers after we got slowed down. Now the airplane we were flying along at cruise was about 150 knots, and we slowed down. I asked Darlene to slow down to about 100 knots, which is a speed we generally use for slow flight maneuvers. And as we slowed down to that 100, you know, Darlene reduced the power, and we're going to maintain that same 3,500 feet until we got down to the speed. And the plan was to then change the configuration of the airplane in terms of adding some flaps, putting the gear down, adding drag, and then Darlene was going to do some left turns, right turns, some climbs and descents in that configuration. But as we reached that 100 knots and we're just about to change the configuration, there was a loud bang in the tail section of the airplane. And I mean a loud one, like a shotgun going off. Certainly not a normal sound. And the immediate reaction of the airplane was that the control wheel came rapidly back into our chest, immediately pitched the airplane up. And as I looked at the artificial horizon and out through the wings versus the horizon, we were well above 45 and the pitch was pushing 55 degrees.
Oh, wow.
And being at the slow speed that we're at, the airplane rapidly entered an accelerated stall. The wings quit flying.
Yeah.
So the airplane then, the stick itself, then the control wheel, pushed all the way forward itself to the panel. And as we added power, as you would do to try to recover from a stall to try to figure out what happened, the airplane pitched down about 40 degrees toward the ground.
Oh, wow.
So this all happened, and the feeling I had, and I turned and at the beginning of this event and looked at Darlene, and she was looking at me as though this was something I induced in the airplane as part of the check ride.
Oh, she thinks this is part of the whole check ride, huh?
Yeah, and I said, Darlene, this isn't me. And I said, I'll take the controls. And she relinquished the controls. And we began to try to keep this airplane from pitching up and pitching down. And each time, and this happened four times to these maximum pitches, the stabilator, now the Seneca, just to define the stabilator, the Seneca has pretty much a full moving horizontal stabilizer on the tail. It doesn't have a fixed stabilizer and a elevator attached to it. The whole horizontal tail section pitches up and down to pitch the airplane up and down. So it's a little different design than what you see on a conventional conventional airplane. Piper uses a lot across many models of their aircraft.
So, John, can I just interrupt you here? So it happens, this loud bang that you can hear over the engine even. The yoke comes all the way back in your lap. Then about the time you're stalling, you go power back in. The yoke goes back towards the dash. And then as soon as the aircraft would start pitching down, the yoke would then come back to your lap. It was just doing these continuous oscillations back and forth?
That's correct. Each time we could feel the stabilator bang full up or full down against the stops. And it was so hard against the fuselage or in the structure that I started to worry about how many of these fluctuations the airplane could stand. Because they were very hard. And we estimate that the G load was exceeding 3 Gs on these first few maneuvers. And I hadn't seen that kind of G load since back in the military days. But that airplane that I was flying was designed to do that.
Right.
Not a Piper Seneca.
So, John, during these oscillations, did you attempt to stop them and you just physically couldn't overcome the force?
Well, as we added that full power when the first stall happened, I found that the extra thrust pitched the airplane down rapidly and pulled back the power then as it pitched down, but not all the way to idle this time. And the oscillations were a little bit less each time. The throttles weren't moved as abruptly, you know, to full forward or full idle. So I kind of figured out that that thrust level had an effect on where the stabilator was going to settle in. And the force on it, you know, both of us were on the wheel, and as it pitched down, we both tried to pull, and we could not overcome the force on the stabilator to get the nose to pitch where we wanted it to. We just couldn't figure out what had happened. You know, we could see a little bit of the tail as we turned and looked toward the rear of the airplane, but from our vantage point, it looked structurally fine, but the reaction we were getting in the pitch up and pitch down was just horrendous.
Man, I can just imagine how frightening that would be to have that happen, that kind of structural problem. You can't overcome it with physical force, but you're finding that you can maintain some level of aircraft control, modulating the power out of sync with the oscillations then.
And luckily, we found a happy medium about mid-power range, about in this airplane that has manifold pressure gauges, about 15 to 17 inches, kept us somewhat in a level flight attitude with maybe plus or minus 10 degrees of pitch oscillations. And we couldn't use, the trim wouldn't work. The force on the stabilator was taking too much power, too much physical power. But I also worried a little bit in my mind that, you know, pulling too hard on this control system to the elevator, we could break it.
Right.
And have nothing.
Yeah.
So there's a limit to what you want to try and pull, you know, like put your feet up on the instrument panel and give it a good yank. That could just, you know, what cables and rods can fail.
Yeah, for all you know, this thing's hanging on by a cable or something back there, you know, and so, man, I can really sense that you're trying to use force to control the airplane, but you're really timid about too much force because you don't know what's holding this thing together back there.
Exactly. And at this point, we still had no idea what the malfunction was. We thought that something hit us. Did we run into something? But at 3,500 feet, there's not even an antenna or anything that we could have clipped. So that was put away as an option. So it's all internal. Something was going on inside that airplane. And as this happened, as I assume control of the airplane, I asked Darlene, who at that point in time, we started this thing as a check ride. Okay, I'm the checker and she's the checkee, so to speak. But when this happened, what was really good to see in retrospect is that I took on the role as a pilot flying, and Darlene became a support role in what we call the pilot monitoring. And the first thing as we were trying to get control of the plane was, we got to let people know that we're having a problem. So I asked Darlene to contact the tower. We were still within range of Conroe Tower, and we still had the frequency on. We could still hear traffic, talking to the tower. So I asked Darlene to get out a mayday to the tower so we could at least let someone know we had a problem and that it's possible we're not going to make it back to the airport. And also asked her to set a code in the transponder, the radar transponder, to indicate that we're having an emergency. Well, we were bouncing so bad in these beginning oscillations that I remember my headset going sideways, my sunglasses were up on my head, this G load was causing lots of issues. And Darlene being, well, she's holding her own in terms of keeping her poise, but you could tell in her voice she was getting a little bit panicky. So when she made that mayday call, she got it out, and I heard the tower respond with our number and said, "Say again." And we were having enough trouble inside the plane. I said, "Darlene, they've heard us enough. Forget that one. They know we're out here. Set the transponder." And as she was trying to get her finger on the buttons of the transponder again, oscillating up and down with that G load, she hit the buttons, and we were going for a code, the emergency code of 7700. But she pushed the buttons, and in all the shaking, got 7600. I said, "Darlene, that's close enough. I know we got a problem, and they'll see us on the radar." And then we went back to figuring out what to do with the airplane. And it was obvious at that point, as I tried to turn toward the Conroe Airport, we were down about 2,000 feet. In all those oscillations, we had gone up and down, but a net result was we lost about 1,500 feet. We were staying about the 110, 120 knots indicated. We never got the airplane dirtied up, so we didn't put any flaps in or no gear. And at that point, we started thinking we could maybe get back to the airport, but as soon as I tried to turn, the oscillations got worse. So somehow the airflow or the control surfaces were reacting to the change in airplane attitude, and it was manifesting itself in moving that stabilator, which appeared to be doing its own thing. It was not reacting to our controls.
And so at this point, you mentioned you lost about 1,500 feet, so you're now only around 1,000 feet AGL.
Correct.
And you're just beginning to think you can kind of control this thing in pitch, but a turn seemed like a bad idea. Where are you in terms of, do you feel like you kind of have control of this airplane? You can at least dampen the oscillations, but how about your ability to control it and move the airplane where you want to?
The probability of us having any precision control on the airplane was out the window. It was only going to be an averaging type control input. And with the pitch up and pitch down, after we decided that, going back to the airport is not going to be an option, we got to get this airplane on the ground. And we were starting to discuss this real fast now because we only have minutes. Because at this point in time, there's a partition in the aft of the cabin. Darlene and I, obviously, in the two front seats. And then normally a Seneca has two rows of two seats each. But in our training airplanes, we have taken all those seats out. We only have one seat behind the co-pilot seat for a jump seater. The rest is all empty cabin. So the partition, it's kind of a, I don't know, cardboard and leather covered partition to keep the cabin separate from the open fuselage, that popped out and fell on the floor. And as I turned from the right front seat and looked back and see it fall on the floor, I could see on the left side of the fuselage, I could see halfway, oh, two-thirds of the way back toward the tail, I could see sunlight coming in the side of the fuselage in a crack that was getting bigger by the minute.
Oh.
And that told me, and I did not tell Darlene this, she didn't see it from turning around. It just cemented in my mind that we got to find our way to the ground as quickly as possible, because it appeared that these slamming, these hard bangs that the stabilator was taking the tail through was eventually going to break the tail off, and then we would have had nothing.
Mm-hmm. So what'd you do?
Well, we went back to that idea of, hey, we found this clearing. It was currently 12 o'clock and about 3 miles, you know, straight ahead for us. And we were about 1,000 feet above the ground, as you mentioned. So I said, Darlene, we got to go for this field. We got to get this airplane on the ground, and we want to get it on the ground in a configuration. We want to land right side up. We don't want to change the configuration that's going to induce more oscillations, especially close to the ground, because even a pitch up or pitch down close to the ground could cause a stall, and then we'd fall onto the ground, and if it pitched down, we just bury it in the field that we had selected. So we had to come up with a plan to manage the energy of the airplane and get it into this field that could give us a chance to survive. The night before, there had been fairly large rain storms, and it had dumped about 6 inches of rain overnight. And up in this area, and I'm from around here, and so is Darlene, and we knew that that kind of rain in that swampy, foresty area was going to cause most fields to be, you know, swampy and mucky. And that would be a challenge if we were landing. And so we decided that we were going to go into the field with wheels up. We did not want to plant the wheels into the mud and then possibly flip the plane. We didn't want to take the chance also to change a configuration and maybe change the control pressure on that stabilator and give us an unexpected pitch up or pitch down. And the same thing with flaps. I was worried that if we added flaps, changed the airflow, whatever's going on the tail. So we decided to leave the airplane in a clean configuration.
John, where was the field when you spotted it and decided you would, was it straight ahead off your nose, off the left or right wing, or where was it?
When we initially saw the field and we kind of put it in our mind as a possibility for an emergency landing site, it was just off our left wing. But during all of this maneuvering after the bang happened and starting to turn to the left, we were heading north, northeast. We wanted to turn toward the south, southwest to head back to Conroe Airport. It wound up, when I gave up on Conroe, being 12 o'clock and, you know, a mile to 2 miles away. So it was right on our nose.
Good. You finally have a little bit of luck here now working for you, in that the field you picked out is now
right
straight ahead of you. And from what you're describing, that was really your only option. You really couldn't turn one direction or the other because you couldn't tell the changes in anything you changed and how the aerodynamics were going to affect whatever was going on in the tail, which appears now from the crack that it's coming apart.
And that was a strong attention getter and really increased the intensity to get this airplane on the ground. And we had one shot, you know, there was no go around planned. We wanted to stay, as I said, right side up and not go nose first or tail first into it. As we got closer to the field, it looked fairly smooth, but again, it was all green grass, and there's some a big pond at the far end of that field, which if we get down in time, we shouldn't worry about sliding into that pond. But the airplane was going too fast, and without the ability to add flaps or put the gear down, we had to figure a way to get that airplane energy diminished a bit. You know, we wanted either the trees, the ground, and the airplane itself to take the brunt of any force that we're going to have during the landing, and not to be us. We wanted to survive. And the only way to do that is to share the impact with other structures other than us, the humans inside the airplane. And the trees in this area around this field were about 100 feet tall, a mixture of pines and different oak trees that are around here in Southeast Texas. So I said, Darlene, we're going to have to take a piece of these trees because the angle of our descent was going to take us into the trees before we got to the open area, the clearing. And I had remembered talking to some firefighters, airborne firefighters, a few months before that usually work the area this time of year because we have a lot of forest fires. And they said that if they ever have to go down, they pick the soft spots going through the trees into a clearing because the branches will help slow you down. And if you don't hit anything, you know, direct, like a trunk of a tree, you're going to reduce your airspeed. And if you time it just right, as you pop out of the trees, you can lose 20, 30 knots at that impact and still not put your airplane out of control. So for some reason, I thought of that discussion over coffee with those fire pilots, and that came into play this day. And as we set up our approach to the field, we knew we were going to just touch the edges and between a bunch of good clumps of trees, but you could see a lot of light through it. So as we were going to enter the trees, I decided to cut the mixture off on each engine, letting them windmill, which would give us some other braking power, but not have any engine power once we hit the trees. And then as we entered the trees, one thing I didn't expect that happened was the twigs and the branches that we went through at about 120. We went in one end and came out the other end about 90, which was great, but the trees knocked the windshield out of the airplane. So we had nothing but air coming in the front, and I don't know where all this plastic plexiglass pieces of windshield went, but they didn't hurt us. And after the trees, we were in a good position to land and came over there was a little barbed wire fence, cleared that. And as we started scraping the belly on the grass, it became obvious that what looked like the surface of the grass being nice and smooth was actually covering a very rough field full of ditches and little boulders and that sort of thing. So we bounced off the top of one, probably went back in the air 5 feet as the left wing caught a little bit of a rise. I don't know if it was a muddy rise or a tree stump, and then twisted the airplane a little bit to the left. And then we slid the rest of the way as this mud from the overnight rain was coming in that windshield that didn't exist. And so we were covered with mud as the airplane came to a stop. But we made it. We were right side up.
Wow.
The airplane took a beating, but we were still coherent. I had really hit the shoulder harness pretty hard. And then with the shoulder harness and the control wheel, I took a pretty good shot in the chest. And for a moment, or a couple minutes, I couldn't breathe. It was like the wind getting knocked out of you. And I looked over, and as I was saying to myself, I can't breathe, I got to breathe. And I looked at Darlene, and she was leaning to the right, and she was down on my, leaning over on my left leg. And I noticed she had a cut on her forehead, a pretty good cut. And as I was trying to breathe, I said, Darlene, we got to get out of this plane. It could catch on fire. And so she was a bit groggy. She had hit her head. I did not hit my head, so I didn't have that issue. So I was able to finally get a little bit of breath and get what was left of the cabin door, which is only on my side of the airplane. That's the only way in and out of the Seneca. And somehow got it knocked off its hinges. And I don't know how I got it thrown over the engine, but I got it out of the way, got my seatbelts off, and climbed out on the wing. And since we were down on our belly, we weren't worried about falling off the wing. Got on the wing and turned around and helped Darlene get her seatbelt off. And she's a smaller person, so she probably weighs 100 pounds. So in my mood, it was no problem getting her up out of the airplane. And we walked off the rear of the right wing, really stumbling. and kind of dragging ourselves to a point maybe 50 to 80 yards toward the 4 or 5 o'clock position of the airplane going away from it. And it was muddy, and I could see crawfish pipes. I don't know if you all know what crawfish are, but they live out in the mud. And then on the dry mounds, there was fire ants. So here we are getting away from an airplane, and now we have to deal with the other challenges. We need to rest. We need to get on the ground. And finally, we found a piece of dry ground that didn't look like it was infested with too much, and just laid down. And Darlene sat down, and I laid on my back and still having a tough time breathing. And as I looked up under the sky, again, a beautiful day, not a cloud in the sky. And just as we laid there, looked above us, an airplane flies over and started circling us. So I knew we'd been seen. So point number one, they know where we are. And I was wearing a pair of like cargo pants that had the big pockets down on the thighs. And my cell phone was still in my pocket. And I pulled it out and was able to see enough to dial 911. And we closed the communication loop. We were able to know that ATC knew where we were, 911 knew where we were, and now we just needed to wait for help to get to us.
Being a pilot is about passion and dedication. The early mornings, hours invested, constantly learning procedures and details, there's a lot to do. Membership in AOPA makes doing the groundwork easier so you can get into the sky. With the power of thousands of pilots united behind you, get access to exclusive resources, practical benefits, and fierce advocacy that helps enhance and protect your freedom to fly. Join us. Visit AOPA.org/membership or give us a call at 800-872-2672.
So, John, that's amazing. Now you finally have a chance to just sort of take this all in as you sit there on that somewhat dry piece of ground, maybe away from the crawfish and the fire ants and the other pests that are out there. I just want to go back and work through this a little bit. The remarkable decision that you made, that you've got this small field that you're going into. You're in this multi-engine airplane that's heavy and comes in relatively fast, and you decide intentionally to fly it through the trees to slow yourself down. That's an amazing decision in the moment.
You know, it all happened in seconds, it seemed like, but as it was happening, this is a hard thing to explain. While it was happening, it seemed like you had inside your mind a little bit longer to figure it out, but in actuality, in real time, it was just a matter of seconds. And I don't know how this came out.
Seconds to make that decision. Yes, seconds. And it almost goes to the value of hangar talk. You know, you said you learned of this in a coffee shop talking to some fire pilots that, you know, are firefighters, and you hear them talking about this scenario where they've talked about this or maybe even used it before. And in the moment, it comes back to you and probably saved your life. Because if you hadn't have done that, you would have had too much speed, too much energy coming into that field. And then who knows how this whole thing ends. It's such an amazing piece of information that you were able to grasp in the moment that you needed it.
And it was vivid, and it worked. I mean, lucky for us, it worked.
It worked. And you said it slowed you down by some 30 knots or so.
Right.
And now you go in and you know, sort of flare into the field. And sure enough, like my friend Mike Vivian taught me, you know, from backcountry flying, if a field looks rough, it is. If it looks smooth, it might be.
Exactly.
And so in your case, it looks smooth, but it was anything but. And now you bounce through this and you're worried about a fire. You've got to extract Darlene. She's bleeding. I'm sure you're worried about that. And you can't breathe and you're able to pull yourself outside of the airplane. Are there any lessons learned in that particular part of it where after you hit, things are jostling around? I can just imagine how disorienting that is.
When you're learning or training about, you know, an off-field landing, usually caused by an emergency, it's always seems that we end that scenario, okay, we got the field made, you know, we're going to land and it's going to be all right. What we don't do, and I'm going to take this into more scenario building as we train our young pilots, what do you do after you land? I mean, what are your concerns after you land? One of them's got to be fire. You got to be able to get out of the plane, and fire is usually, it's got to be caused by something. One, we had over 90 gallons of gas still in the airplane, so that would have made a big fire if there had been a ignition source.
Yeah.
So shutting off the mixture controls. I didn't go for the gas valves because that would have been taking my eye off the ball too much to reach down between the seats where that main valve's to shut off. And I do remember in retrospect, we discussed landing with no flaps, no gear. Well, obviously we landed without the gear, but in that first bounce, we bounced maybe 5 feet in the air. And as I looked forward through the open windshield, I wanted to slow our slide as much as we could. So I reached down, and this airplane has manual flaps. So there's a handle between the two front seats. And so as we were in the air in that first bounce, I remember putting the flaps down. I didn't worry about the tail changing at that low altitude because the engines were off. Mm-hmm. And it seemed like that kind of scraped the ground, those flaps hanging down, and actually helped us slow down faster because we were approaching that pond at the far end of this field rapidly to begin with. And it was a big one. I found out later that if we'd have gone in it, it was one of those man-made ponds that was pretty deep instantly. Mm. It wasn't like you had a shallow beach. So that would have added another problem to the whole scenario, being in the water.
Yeah. Well, you, after that first bounce, having the presence of mind to reach down and add flaps just to slow yourself down as much as you can, because that's the name of the game in one of these off-airport control crashes, right, is get yourself as slow as possible. The least amount of energy you can carry into that, the better. So you reach and grab the flaps to slow yourself down. I'm just thinking of the Bob Hoover quote that we all have learned, and that is fly all the way through the crash. I'm paraphrasing, but boy, you were doing that in spades here. I mean, you're flying through trees intentionally. You're bouncing and still adding flaps and still working this thing all the way until it came to a full stop. An amazing presence of mind. So once you get on the ground there, and because you had the presence of mind to say, hey, Darlene, send a mayday call to tower, so they start launching people your direction before you even hit the ground. Now, how did they actually get you out of there?
Well, we talked to 911. I was talking on my phone, and then I needed to keep Darlene conscious. She had been hit in the head pretty hard, and she was bleeding pretty good from her head wound, and I needed to talk to somebody. So, and she wanted to call her parents and all that. I said, here's 911. So she took my phone, and she was talking on it while she was taking one of her shirts and rolled it up as a compression that she could put on her head to slow the bleeding down. Now, we waited, I guess, 30 to 40 minutes for first responders to get to us. As close as they could get to us was maybe quarter to 3/8 of a mile, and the rest was too muddy. They couldn't even get their all-terrain vehicles through the mud and stuff. So as I heard them coming, and 911 was telling Darlene on the phone that they see you, they're walking toward you, I'm laying down. I couldn't see them coming, but I could hear them making a ruckus. They walked in and they took care of each of us, and we got on a gurney or a stretcher and kind of tied in, and they carried us that far to some all-terrain vehicles, put us on these all-terrain vehicles, and then got to the ambulance near a little road. And we were out in the middle of the country between two little burgs here in southeast Texas. And these were volunteer fire folks, but they were very, very good. And the helicopter had been dispatched, and they said they were going to take me by air to the trauma center. And it got changed to where I was breathing better, but Darlene had that bleeding issue. So they decided to take her in the helicopter, which landed in, I don't know how he got down into these trees from what I could see laying on my back, but they landed and got Darlene. And I rode the 30 minutes to the nearest trauma center. And then we were both admitted to the hospital. It's kind of a blur after that happened.
Did they figure out what your breathing issue was? What was causing that breathing difficulty?
I had a broken sternum. So that's right in the center of the chest. And when they broke the sternum, it actually put a large bruise on my heart. And that was pretty painful. And that's what they watched. But in addition, I had a lot of bruises. The main bruises were from the shoulder harness, which on one hand, it bruised me up. But on the other hand, it did its job and kept me from, you know, flying through the windshield or whatever might have happened.
Absolutely. I think that's one of the easiest and most important things for people to do is make sure they have shoulder harnesses.
Exactly.
How long would you estimate, John, from the time that your crash stopped, came to a rest, until the time that the first responders met you? How much time elapsed?
I believe it was 45 minutes. It wasn't much more than that. I was pleasantly surprised that it was that quick, but turns out that the tower had gotten a jump on it and was able to call and got a general idea where we were going to go down. And so everything worked. I mean, the communication, the tower sprung into action, the airplane flying over us. The first one was from another flight school at Conroe Airport. And then when they left the scene, one of our airplanes came over and was able to talk to our dispatch, was able to, you know, put into play our emergency response plan for an event like this. We have these plans, and everybody went into action and did their job. As we debriefed after all that, we can say that should we make some modifications? Well, a little here and there, we always learn something new. But to have that and to know it all came and worked, it was just amazing. And thankfully, it worked timely.
I would say it all worked timely, largely because you had the presence of mind to start initiating it even before you went down with the Mayday call. And then an important little element here to this story is you had your cell phone on you. And that's another thing I've learned in backcountry flying is what's on your body is survival equipment. Anything else in the aircraft is camping equipment.
Right.
So if you really need stuff that you think you might really need, you've got to have physically on your body. And your situation reinforces that. And sure enough, you had your cell phone so you could pull it out and call 911. So it all worked well, and I'm glad the responders were there and they did their job. I think the key part of that is you initiated that and you were prepared for it. I want to talk about what happened to your airplane, but I kind of want to get to Darlene and her check ride. I mean, so whatever happened to, you're obviously back flying again, and we're happy to hear that. How about Darlene? What's her status?
While we were sitting on the ground in the field, Darlene said to me, does this mean I passed my check ride? And I go, well, nice try, Darlene, but I think I can give you the steep turns and we can do the short field landing, soft field landing, emergency landing, but we got a few more things to do, and we laughed about that. She's pretty good sense of humor. I had broken ribs and cracked my pelvis and all of that stuff. So we had each had a little different but painful couple months, you know, from May through May and June. I, you know, got a letter from the FAA medical a couple months after the accident because the NTSB listed our accident as having serious injuries. So the FAA follows up with that and wants to know a little bit more about what the injuries are, what your status is and all that. They're not taking away your medical because you are, as a pilot with a medical, you kind of self-police yourself in these kind of things. And like if you're taking medication for pain and all of that, you don't go flying. So I worked through all of that. And just now, last week, I got my medical renewed and the FAA is happy with the x-rays and everything on follow-up. So I've pretty much got a clear path ahead. But FAA is taking a pretty good interest in how people recover from these things. It was kind of odd to get a letter from the FAA and says, hey, I understand you had an accident. We hope you're recovering nicely. Now, this is from the FAA. But then the next paragraph, however, we want to do this, this, and this. And if you don't answer within 60 days, we could do something more invasive, so to speak. Mm. But the relationship with the FAA and the NTSB, they also did their job. And when, I don't know if it's normal, but the very next day in the hospital, you know, I got in late afternoon on Wednesday, and Thursday morning, I'm kind of waking up in the hospital, and my wife's sitting there, and there's this other fella sitting there. And I said to my wife, who's the guest? And he says, I'm from the FAA. I'm here to help you. Now, there's the old line.
Right, yeah.
But he was an inspector, you know, doing a job and wanting to interview to see what they could do to start putting together an accident investigation. Mm. Now, he told me, you know, he was there not to interrupt my recovery, but if I felt like it, and talk about whatever happened. And I certainly said that, you know, it's kind of hard to talk when I don't know what kind of drugs I'm on.
Yeah.
But we chatted a little bit about the accident, and then he went on his way.
Yeah, and it would be perfectly understandable and probably advisable for you at that point to say, I'm in no condition to talk about this accident with you, because there's nothing really good that can come to you from having that conversation with an FAA investigator in your hospital room. But I'm glad it worked out well for you. How about, is Darlene's spirits okay? I mean, is she thinking she wants to get back into flying again and get back on the horse, or where is she mentally?
Her mental state is that she wants to continue and finish. She did go up once just to fly with another pilot when she felt good enough. And she said there was a little bit of apprehension there, you know, like that any little bump or bang kind of got her attention, but that kind of went away. And said, you know, that's normal. Some people would take this kind of a event and say, you know what, I'm going to take another career path. But Darlene said, well, this is probably the worst it's going to get for the rest of my career. And I want to finish this. I want to be in this career field and be able to become hopefully someday an airline pilot.
Yeah, well, good for her. So, John, can we go back to, have you heard from anyone, the FAA or maintenance or anyone, what happened to the airplane? What caused that?
When the FAA inspector heard that, I told him that we heard this loud bang in the back of the airplane, and that was one of his notes, and he told the NTSB inspector. And later on, I was on the phone with NTSB inspector, and he said when the FAA told him that, he knew exactly where to look. So they sent people out to the field and got to the airplane, and all the still it was muddy, and found that what had happened was a bolt had broken and left the airplane. And this bolt was pretty important. It held the control rod that came from our control yoke or column that handled the anti-servo tab that's on this stabilator. Now, this is kind of hard to picture, but as I mentioned, the stabilator is like a full flying tail. The horizontal stabilizer moves up and down in total as it moves to change the pitch of the airplane. The anti-servo tab is a tab or a piece of sheet metal that goes about the entire trailing edge of the stabilator. It almost looks like a little elevator on the end of the stabilator, but it's controlled by this rod that, if you picture, you know, the airplane pitching up, you would pull back on the yoke and it would tend to make the stabilator, the front part of it, the leading edge, go down, which would dive the tail and make the nose rise. And the anti-servo tab is designed to go in the same direction as the trailing edge of the stabilator, but more rapidly in that direction. And the whole idea of the anti-servo tab is to dampen the control input from the stabilator so that it doesn't over-control. If you didn't have this anti-servo tab, it would be very difficult to control the airplane. It'd be so sensitive to pitch inputs that a pilot would be over-controlling all the time. So the engineers put this device in to the system.
To dampen that, to help make it easier to control, I got it. So, sure enough, when that broke on you, that bolt that connects that anti-servo tab, now that thing is back there flapping pretty aggressively and moving your horizontal stabilizer so aggressively that it ends up cracking your tail.
And because it pushed it all the way to the stops, you know, full up, full down, full up, full down. And actually the tab, when it became disconnected, it was, like you said, freewheeling in the airflow, and any little deflection up or down, and it would actually be working in reverse of what it was designed for. So it helped the control smash one way or the other. And I mean smash, because that's where it was really going, was back and forth, up and down. And that bolt, which we look at during the pre-flight, it's visible coming out the tail cone, and you look under the stabilator, under the horizontal stabilizer area, and you'll see the rod with a bushing coming out of the tail, and then there's a bracket on the tab that a bolt goes through the bracket and the bushing and holds the rod in place and connected to the stabilator. And that's the bolt which was connected with a what they call a castle nut, which is a nut that has grooves in it so that once you put the nut on the bolt, then you can put cotter pins through the bolt and through the notches in the nut to keep it from working itself off. Now, this bolt, when we look at it, you know, it looks normal. You see a bolt and it's painted white like the airplane is, and you see the cotter pin, good to go. We had no way of knowing that somehow inside that bushing or in that bracket, wear and tear over the many years that bolt's there caused that bolt to weaken, and under the pretty good force that it sees during flight, the bolt gave way and both halves fell out, and the rest is our story.
Mm. So this is interesting to me. The NTSB investigator, hearing the description of the loud boom in the back, knew exactly where to go. How did he know that? That indicates that they've had this problem before.
He told me on the phone that he had investigated a few instances of these controls coming apart in flight. And two of them were in Alaska. He said there was one in England that he read about. And he was in on both of those in Alaska. That's where he's based, this particular NTSB folks. And he told me that, well, it was kind of shook me up when he said, I've seen a number of these accidents, but you're the first pilot we've ever been able to interview after the fact. And I had to sit down and take a breath after that one.
Because you're the only one that survived it.
That's what he said in that many words. And we were lucky to be able to explain what we heard, what we saw from our end, because NTSB was only able to see a crashed airplane before. It was I don't know how to say that. It was a little bit of a shock to hear that. But on the other hand, it gave us some good information. Our training department, we happen to own about 15% of the world's inventory of Senecas. And there is no airworthiness directive ever, I'm sure there's going to be, about changing this bolt out after so many hours of use. I know that when they do work on a control system, that they put new fasteners in, but this one looked pretty much original, and this airplane was built in 1976, so it had some hours on it. Mm-hmm. But we went ahead and changed every bolt in every Seneca, and we took each bolt under the direction of NTSB, identified it on what airplane it was on and how many hours and so on, put it in a little plastic bag, and NTSB's got all those bolts to see if there's anything to indicate some kind of a wear and tear issue that FAA could turn around and say, here's what we need to change out there in the world to keep this from happening again.
Well, and that's the power of the investigation with the NTSB and the FAA working together with the pilot community, that when it all comes together like that, that's how we've been able to make aviation safer and safer through the years in this country, and especially general aviation. John, that is just a remarkable piece of flying to have a structural failure like that in your stabilator area, and to figure out in pretty short order that the only control you have is through power, And then to be able to identify a place to put it down and how to put it down is just an incredible piece of flying. But it's not so much the stick and rudder skills. It was really the mental skills that helped you through this piece of flying, the head work, if you will. And I just have to think that all of your experiences, you said you were a military pilot, then you flew for the airlines for many years, and you immediately transitioned from this DPE student relationship to a crew, and that probably came very natural to you given your background and was pretty helpful in this scenario to help you just think through and utilize all the resources available to you to help a positive outcome.
Exactly right. You know, awareness of your surroundings and the situation and awareness of your resources, whether it's the tower, the cell phone, other people's ideas, and just things that stick with you, they seem to pop up when you really need them. And this all happened in a matter of minutes. And here we talked about it just now, today, probably three times longer than the whole event took. But there's just a lot of retrospect, and hopefully we take this information and put it out into the aviation arena where all of our peers and potential pilots and students of aviation are all going to listen and read and just take in this information, and someday you might need to use it.
Well, that's the idea, and we're able to do it because people like you are willing to share your story. We're so thankful for the positive outcome for you, and we're hoping for the best for Darlene and a full recovery and her back into flying. We thank you so much for joining us today, John, and sharing your remarkable story with us.
You're very welcome, Richard. Thank you for letting me tell the story.
Well, that is a remarkable piece of flying by John Bloom. And it really wasn't his stick and rudder skills, although he needed those. It was his head work. It was his thinking. It was his experience. All of that came to matter for him in a situation where seconds mattered. Put yourself in that cockpit where you can imagine you're going too fast and you purposely decide to fly it into the top of the trees to slow you down. That kind of thinking, that kind of confidence comes from a lot of experience, a lot of hangar talk, thinking through situations and being prepared should that moment ever happen. It stands as a great example for the rest of us of how to be ready should something so unpredictable happen to us in the air. We're thankful for John and Darlene, and we wish them both a speedy recovery. Thanks for joining us on this edition of There I Was. Alongside our producer, David O'Leary, I'm your host, Richard McSpadden. Until next time, fly safe. Hey, listeners, we want to thank you for making this one of the most popular aviation podcasts there is. Thanks to you, our listeners, for your engagement, for following us, and for your likes and subscribes on whether it's iTunes or Spotify. Those mean a lot to us and help us expand the aviation reach and our aviation safety message. If you'd like to help us and become a supporter of these podcasts, please consider a donation to the AOPA Foundation. That's aopafoundation.org. Thanks for your support, and thanks for making this podcast so successful.
There I Was is produced by the AOPA Air Safety Institute. If you'd like to hear other episodes, submit comments, or submit your own story to potentially be featured on the show, please visit airsafetyinstitute.org/thereiwas. Thanks for listening.